so very far away. The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our show. We have a very interesting one tonight, one that I hope you'll listen to. And we're going to start off talking about Aztec and the UFO crash that happened there in 1948. And we will have Mark McClandish here on a moment, who now lives in Northern California. But Mark went to Aztec, to the crash site, several years ago. And I think you'll find his interview very interesting, as he gives you kind of a first-hand account about Aztec and the ambience of it. We had a little bit of that when we talked to Katie McClure, the director of the Aztec Symposium. We talked to her last week, remember? It's coming up here very shortly, and I would urge people to think about attending March 25th and 26th in Aztec, New Mexico. I'm going to run down who is there, and we will go over that in a little bit. But we want to give you a website to check, aztecufo.com. And you can see for yourself, but as I say, later in the program, we'll run down who's appearing there, and the prices are right, $25. That's right, only $25 for the Saturday session, and if you want to go to the meet and greet the night before, I think you'll find that's even more reasonable, $15. And there are discounts for senior citizens, as well as first responders and members of the military. A lot of interesting things, including a follow-up by Lynn Buchanan on the remote viewing exercise they did last year with 11 remote viewers around the world focusing in on Aztec. And the findings, they were just short of phenomenal, and some of it was rather disturbing, including the possibility of at least one E.T. being shot by U.S. Army troops on the scene. All of that will be covered in Aztec, New Mexico, in detail on Saturday, March 26th, in a preview, and a nice meal the night before, plus music by Norio Hayakawa, one of our favorite people. And he's a very talented guy, in addition to being a very intellectual person and one of the better UFO researchers. But right now, let's bring on Mark McClandish. We have Mark McClandish with us on the line from Redding, California, or thereabouts. And Mark is quite an interesting fellow, as you know. We've had him on the air before, and we'll have him on the air again. But Mark, back in the 90s, went to Aztec. And he'll tell us in this interview why. And he visited the crash scene. It was all because of a book that he read called UFO Crash at Aztec. And it was written by the late, great Wendell Stevens along with William Steinman. And that book, I believe, is still available at Amazon, at least. And it was quite an inspiring book. As you'll hear, and when Mark talks to us, he checked everything out, and Wendell and William had it pretty much down right as far as the facts about the crash scene and things like that. Anyway, Mark, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to hearing this story. You were quite taken with this book, I take it.
Well, the book was published jointly by Wendell Stevens and William S. Steinman. In fact, I've got the ISBN number here for anybody who's trying to find a copy of this. It's 0-934-269-05-X. And anyway, I was kind of intrigued by, you know, these stories of crash retrievals like the one that occurred in Roswell. And apparently this particular crash happened a little less than a year after the Roswell crash. In fact, sort of the funny coincidence in all of this is that it happened on my birthday, March 25th, about 5 years before I was born. So in 1948.
And so what conclusion do we draw? That you were part of that Aztec crash? An E.T. among us?
Yeah, I know we were joking earlier about how I might have been a reincarnated alien or something. But anyway, so I picked up a copy of the book, and it turned out that a year or two after that, I was living in Southern California at the time, I had picked up a ZF transaxle out of a 74 Pantera that I needed to have rebuilt. And I had a little Fiero that I was contemplating turning into some kind of a kit car project, you know, make it look like a Ferrari or something. So I decided that I would take out the passenger seat in this Fiero, put a piece of plywood on the floor of the passenger side, and basically strap down this giant transaxle on the floor of the Fiero and drive cross country up to a spot in Illinois where the ZF company had a transaxle repair center. Apparently some of the drivetrain components for the Corvette that was, I think it was a C5 Corvette that had kind of a split drivetrain where the transmission was in the back. Also was using some ZF components, so they set up a repair installation here in the United States. It's called ZF of North America, I believe. Anyway, so I was going to drive cross country to drop off this transmission because it seemed like it'd be cheaper and more reliable than sending something this big and heavy through the mail or with UPS. And I figured as long as I was going to do that, I would pass down through New Mexico where I had some relatives living in the area of Clovis and Albuquerque. And this particular site was right along the way. I also went up and visited the area around the Archuleta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico.
Oh, really? You'll have to tell me about that, too.
Yeah, it was a very strange experience. But anyway, in the book by Wendell Stevens and Steinman, on pages 32 and 33, there was actually a map in there showing where the crash location occurred. And it's probably about two-thirds of the way up a canyon called Hart Canyon. And I actually, you know, by looking at the topography and the map, plus the map that I had, and the fact that there's an awful lot of petroleum industry drilling operations in this area, so it wasn't too hard to have or to run across someone who could say, oh, yeah, you go down this way, and you make a right, and you follow it out, and you'll... So it just so happens that it's sort of a tributary canyon off of a much larger canyon for, let's see, it looks like the Animas River, which kind of comes in from the north into the town of Aztec itself. And so the crash location's actually a little bit north and to the east of the city or the town of Aztec. And the book, the cover of the book actually has a photograph on the front of it that shows kind of a low cliff, rock escarpment that's just immediately to the east of where the crash occurred. And one of the landmarks that's described in the map of the actual crash site, it's on the next page, page 34, it actually shows a large concrete block. Now, there's been some debate about what this concrete block was for, whether it was used as the foundation for some kind of a crane that they literally installed overnight to give them a support for lifting pieces of this craft onto a number of flatbed trailers. The biggest problem they had, according to the book, was this 100-foot diameter saucer, which had kind of a spherical crew compartment buried right at the center of it, and the crew compartment was about 18 feet in diameter, more of it sort of sticking out above the center line of the craft than below. It was essentially a seamless looking vehicle, and the only thing that the only access point that they had were a number of mirrored glass panels on the upper part of the crew compartment, one of which appeared to have been broken. And there's no specifics about what may have caused that, whether it was a meteorite impact or whether this thing had been shot at. But they could not figure out how to get into this thing to break it down and basically transport it across country. And eventually what they did was they found this opening in one of these windows. They took a long stick and they started poking at some of the buttons that they saw in the crew compartment, and one of them actually caused a kind of a hatchway to drop down from the underside of the craft. And so that's how they were eventually able to get access to this vehicle. And William Steinman apparently tracked down and interviewed a number of people who'd been involved in photographing the crash for the military, who were able to describe, you know, what happened, how they logistically supported the removal of the craft from the site. It turns out that Hart Canyon is pretty much, probably about 100 to 200 foot wide dry riverbed that runs sort of in a west-southwest to east-northeast sort of a direction. And then it makes an abrupt turn to the north right at this rock escarpment that I was describing earlier. So the one outstanding landmark on this particular site is this large cement block that seems to have been a part of this removal operation. And so I actually found that. And, in fact, I'm looking at the site on Google Earth right now. And for your listeners, I can actually give them the coordinates of this cement block. It's 36 degrees, 51 minutes, 58 seconds, and 0.78 inches north by 108 degrees, 1 minute, 4 seconds, and 0.73 inches west, at an elevation of just under 6,000 feet above sea
level. Now, you actually saw this block yourself in person.
Yes, I did. That cement block was still there in about 91 or 92 when I passed through the area. It, of course, it's all sort of, you know, dilapidated now, covered with moss and, graffiti and things like that. I don't think anybody there really appreciates or understands what this thing was.
Mark, can you give our listeners a little bit of your impression of the place?
Looked around the site. In the book, the person who eventually found the site, I believe it was probably William Steinman himself, said that there were areas of the ground that appeared to have been scorched. Rocks that had discoloration on them. And in my, I've always been kind of a rock hound. I grew up in parts of Arizona and did a lot of fossil hunting and things. And so I spent a lot of time trying to recognize different kinds of geology, different kinds of rocks, and the things that I saw that might have been perceived as scorched rocks really looked to me as though they were rocks that had just experienced a lot of weathering, probably had a high iron content in them, and so the iron content, it tends to corrode and rust and turn sort of a brownish color, so it does look scorched. Although I think it's really just a patina from the iron oxide that's sort of leaching out of the rock itself rather than some kind of a temperature problem or some exposure to higher temperature. And the way that I tried to sort this out in terms of validating whether or not that really was the case was I went several hundred yards in every other direction to see whether there were also rocks in those areas that exhibited these same kind of features, and that's exactly what I found. So it was fairly uniform throughout the area. There were a couple of, it looked like pieces of old rusty rebar with some steel plates welded to the end of them, and there were a lot more of these found at the time that William Steinman located the crash site, and some of them appeared to have been, according to his testimony, appeared to have been welded together into what would amount to sort of a, I guess it would be like a three-sided pyramid sort of thing, where they took the, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably eight rods, welded them into like a little triangular-shaped pyramid with pads in different areas to support the craft or hold it up off the ground so they could get underneath it and through this doorway, because it was right on the ground. It's kind of crashed, made an impact on one side of Hart Canyon, and then sort of bounced back into the air and then came to rest on the other side, the north side of Hart Canyon, coming in from, I think it was the southeast, if I'm not mistaken. But that, you know, they the soils in this area are extremely sandy. The area that's just to the north of Hart Canyon where this thing came to rest really isn't much more solid in terms of footing than the actual floor of this dry riverbed called Hart Canyon itself. So it was kind of interesting to be there. I didn't expect to find little pieces of foil with alien writing on them or anything like that, but it did appear as though something had happened there at one time, and it's really kind of hard to tell based on what I found, that it had anything to do with the impact of, you know, a craft from some other solar system.
But so potentially what you saw up there years later were items, small little items that might have been used in the retrieval of the craft.
Yes. Yeah, and that was the assertion that was made in the book. I mean, you know, it seems pretty odd that you would be out in the middle of the desert, as it were, and find this this large cement block. I would have estimated that it was, it was hard to tell how deep it went down below the soil, but it was at least 3 feet above the ground when I was there. And I would say it was at least, maybe 15 feet long, about 9 feet wide. So it was a pretty substantial mass of concrete. And it looked as though it had been poured into some kind of a quickly formed, form that was, sort of a mold that mm-hmm. was constructed out of either plywood or wooden planks, because you could see the grain of wood in some of the areas of the concrete itself.
What about those that say, well, that's all oil field debris, because oil field operations go on there?
You know, there are a number of other oil field operations in that area, as I was saying before, but generally if you're thinking of something like this as being a well that's been capped off, you're going to have some kind of a fixture on the top of it, or maybe even a piece of steel pipe that goes down through the middle of it that's been cut off, and then a cap has been welded to the top of it, and there was nothing like that at all. In fact, there wasn't even anything at the site designating that this was part of or property of any kind of an oil company or an oil company operation. It was just a big cement block, just 100 feet or so north of this dry riverbed.
Mark, I know you're a very practical, technical guy, but while you're up there, did you feel some vibes, some ambience of what might have happened?
Well, I try to be sensitive to those kinds of things. I did have one of the things that they tell you about the desert as an environment is that it's a really sensitive kind of place. There are places out near Fort Ord in the high desert north of Los Angeles where even now, 60 years later, you can still see the trails left by the tanks that Patton and his people, his troops, left when they were doing training exercises for some of the invasions that occurred during the Second World War. You can still see the tracks left by those tanks. And so, when you look at the environment, one of the things that I tried to do was to see if there were any kinds of marks or things that had sort of filled in over time where the vegetation hadn't really grown back at the same rate as some of the other surrounding areas of sagebrush and things around there. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, I would imagine that if I was part of a recovery team and there was going to be any question about whether the site had significance down the road, one of the things that I would really go out of the way to do would be to remove as much evidence of any kind of logistical operation as possible. Now, even now when I look at this site on Google Earth, you can see evidence of heavy equipment having moved through the area. Now, to my eye, it looks like something that's happened a little bit more recently. But there do seem to be some residual marks that show some kind of activity happened there many years ago. You can see areas where the sort of random distribution of the sagebrush seems to be interrupted with a clear margin in two areas of this particular site that almost suggests some kind of heavy equipment or bulldozer was brought in at some point and something had been moved around. And, you know, you generally don't expect to see that out in a remote area where there's not a lot of activity going on. But that's not to say that it couldn't have been something that happened, you know, in the 50 years since then because of all the oil drilling activity that's going on in the area, whether it's a survey crew in a Jeep or, you know, somebody bringing some pipe in to, connect a newly drilled oil derrick to, a supply system. So it's really hard to tell. There's all kinds of piping going through the entire canyon. So it's a very active site in terms of the oil industry. It's kind of a toss-up in terms of whether anything that you can see there geographically is a result of some kind of logistics operation for moving the craft. One of the things they did mention in the book that I thought was kind of interesting was that the craft was apparently assembled in pie-shaped sections, but the joining of the different metal components was so seamless, so perfect. It was almost as though the pieces had been all brought together and then the entire craft had been put on a giant lathe and everything had been smoothed out so one piece to the next was so perfectly smooth you literally couldn't see the seams between the different parts of the craft. And it wasn't until after they gained access to the craft that they actually found a number of interlocking key-like mechanisms that would allow them to disengage one segment from the next, and the whole thing came apart like a big puzzle. And they were able to break it down, stack the pieces, put them under a big tarp on a flatbed truck, one or more flatbed trucks, and haul them off. There's some indication that after the Roswell crash, the military had established something called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, or IPU.
Tell me about that.
Well, they claim that this was a scientific branch of the military. It was based out of Camp Hale in Colorado. Now, the other thing that they talk about is the fact that some of these things were transported to a base up in Colorado, and that it was then flown from there to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was in or near Dayton, Ohio. But
Mark, you mentioned Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and you're no stranger to that area. You actually have a painting of Billy Mitchell, or did, on display at Wright-Patterson.
Well, that's right. There is a painting. I don't know if the building itself is open to the general public, but it was the Billy Mitchell or General Billy Mitchell Memorial Logistics Center for B-1 and B-2 systems in the Air Force. It's the building that where all of the data processing and logistical direction for supplying the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber systems throughout the Air Force. It's where all the coordination for that activity occurs, and they've got a very large lobby. It's probably 3.5 stories high inside, and there was a request that came to me from interior design firm back in that area that asked me to do a a vertical format 16-by-20-foot mural for that building.
Yeah, Mark, we knew about that. In fact, we know quite a lot about you. Our researchers, our producers have found out that you're a pretty innovative fellow. So this story about taking this transactyls to Illinois in this little car is not unusual for you.
Well, I've done some crazy things. You should have seen the problem with creating a painting of that size in a vertical format in a place like Reading is that it can be pretty expensive to rent an industrial shop space with a ceiling that's over 20 feet high, especially if you're going to create the painting in the same kind of perspective that one would expect to see it in the lobby of this building. And I simply could not find any site in Reading that had over a 20-foot ceiling where I could spend several months doing a painting. And coincidentally, I had a Cadillac Northstar engine, which had also been part of this proposed kit car project. The sad thing about it was that after I got the transmission rebuilt, I was coming into town, moving my Fiero, and a lady pulled out of a side street without looking, and I T-boned her car and totaled my Fiero. So
oh, man, suddenly, after all that trouble.
I know. It was my pride and joy. I just loved that little car. It totaled the Fiero, and so I had
did to... Did it hurt you?
For the transmission or the Northstar engine. That was kind of be my yeah. engine-transmission combination. When I put an ad in the paper to sell the the Northstar engine, turned out I was contacted by a fellow who was interested in buying the engine. The funny thing was he called me from Hawaii, and I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to get this engine to Hawaii? And he said, oh, no, I live near Reading. He says, I'm on vacation, and, I want to see the engine when I get back. So please don't sell it to anybody else. And apparently his wife had a Cadillac. The engine had burned up. And so sold him the engine, and as I'm taking it over to his place, he's got this giant garage with 16-and-a-half-foot ceilings. And I said, say, Gary, do you think that maybe... So we made a deal, and he let me spend about the next 8 months assembling this giant scaffold to actually do the painting. And it wound up, if you've ever seen those reversible chalkboards that they have in college where it has sort of a rolling A-frame with two pivot points at each end, and you can flip the chalkboard over to do equations and then, flip it over. Imagine something like that where the pivot point is about 9 feet off the ground and you're using 4x6 lumber and giant casters, and I got a 21-foot long piece of 3-inch steel pipe, and I created a series of trusses on the back of this thing with struts and outriggers that went out to the edge of this 16-by-20-foot stretcher board that was faced with masonite to give me a firm backing, and then I had a custom canvas stitched together by a company that makes boat covers. And, stretched the thing over this backing, stapled all, it must have used 3,000 staples around the edges, and put a gesso primer on it and started painting after they'd approved the composition. And the funny thing about it was they wanted the face of Billy Mitchell to be fairly large in this format. His face wound up being something like 6 feet high. And so if you imagine having a picture of your face blown up and... every little pore and acne scar from when you were a teenager. And the thing was that Billy Mitchell had a lot of battle scars from the First World War and a lot of pock marks from when he was a teenager. Apparently he had a lot of problems with his skin. And so, I had to be sort of delicate about how I illustrated this gentleman because, after all, who wants to see that kind of...
3-foot acne. We don't want to see that. Mark... this is an incredible thing you did. In fact, almost everything you've done is pretty incredible. You actually rolled this thing up and drove it across country in a snowstorm.
Now, I had several people that agreed to help me dismantle this thing. I wanted to maintain the 2x2 structure that made up the lion's share of the stretcher framework that this thing would be reassembled on once I got it to Wright-Patterson. And, you know, I couldn't find any truck that was large enough to transport it intact. It would not even fit into a normal semi-truck, and it would have been exorbitantly expensive. I mean, just astronomically expensive to transport all the way to Dayton, Ohio from, you know, Redding, California. So I had to find some kind of innovative way to transport this thing, and so I had an 89 Maxima, and I found that when these cars were shipped over from Japan, they put these brackets on the lower part of the frame, the chassis, that they would use to tie these things down on these big transport ships so they wouldn't move around if the ship encountered rough seas. And so I used those pickup points on the frame to have a steel framework. It was using three-eighths inch thick, 4-inch wide steel plate that I had cut to various dimensions, basically had a series of bolts that, and grade 10 bolts and grade 12 bolts that extended down from the frame out beyond the bumper and then formed an A-frame that had cross supports on it, all screwed together with these grade 10 bolts. And then it had two pieces of steel that were bent into the shape of like half of an octagon, like the lower half of a stop sign shape. And that was the cradle for a 22-foot long piece of 10.5-inch diameter sewer pipe with caps on each end. It's sort of a turquoise green PVC pipe of some kind.
You probably got a lot of attention hauling this thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was so funny because every time we came to a stop, I had a friend of mine came up from Las Vegas, and he helped me drive this thing around the clock ahead of a major snowstorm, as you were saying. Across country, up through the Rocky Mountains, through Salt Lake City, and across country like that. And we were racing a snowstorm all the way across the country, and it caught up with us by the time we got to Salt Lake. And we just barely got up the west side of the Rockies, climbing up into the mountains, going into Wyoming. I'd left my snow tires and my chains at home because we didn't have any room in the car because I had to bring all my tools to reassemble this thing once we got on site. But basically, what I had to do was I had to pull all these staples to get this thing off of the Masonite, pulled it free, and then I unscrewed and disassembled the 2x2 stretcher frame that would be the underlying structure for this thing once it got to the base. And I rolled, I basically took all these 2x2s, some of which were 16 and, 20 feet long, wrapped them up into a bundle, and then I wrapped the painting around those 2x2s, sort of like the classic Greek faggot. That's what it was called, a bundle of sticks, which symbolized the strength of union. And then single-handedly had to lift this thing up into the tube that was already above my car. It weighed several hundred pounds, so I could only really lift one end of it at a time and then try to lift the other end, and it would bow, and it didn't want to go in. I kind of had to bounce the thing, so the whole thing was sort of wobbling up and down like a giant sine wave made out of canvas and sticks. And, eventually fed this thing into this giant tube, got it all the way in, and then ran home, took a shower, jumped in the car, and headed for Reno, Nevada, where I met up with my buddy. And the funniest part of the whole thing was when people would stop at gas stations and they'd say, "You've got some deep sea fishing rigs in there, right? You're going deep sea fishing. You've got your rod and reels in there, right?" I had one guy say, "My buddy and I, we've been trying to guess what you have in your giant tube there, and we figure it's a full scale set of drawings for a house, right?" Like giant blueprints or something.
Yeah.
Later this week, we'll have the entire interview with Mark McCandish on our website at jerrypippin.com. And basically, Mark is going to tell us a little bit about his other adventures in New Mexico. And one of those adventures was at a place called Dulce at the Archuleta Mesa. And actually, he spent the night, most of the night. He had some pretty spooky things happen to him. And he jumped in his car and out of his sleeping bag, where he was asleep on top of the mesa, and left. So, also, Mark will talk about his adventures at Area 51. That'll be coming up later this week on our website, jerrypippin.com, J-E-R-R-Y, PIPPIN.com, all one word, of course. Let's talk a little bit about the symposium at Aztec. We promised you we have run down who's going to be there and what's going to be happening. One of the interesting speakers this year, and by the way, it's March 25th and 26th in Aztec. On Saturday is when the speakers will be around. It's only $25 to attend the entire thing, and they have senior citizens discounts on top of that, plus first responders and military people get them free. Anyway, go over to AztecUFO.com and see more details if you'd like, and register, especially if you're going to the dinner on Friday night. All the speakers will be there, including Norio Hayakawa, who will be entertaining in his one-man band. If you've never heard Norio in person, you need to. Very interesting fellow. Speaking of interesting fellows, one of the people speaking this year is someone I don't know. Marshall Klanfeld. He's a researcher on ancient UFOs and aliens. And this research can prove that extraterrestrials actually created man in their own image. Marshall Klanfeld's groundbreaking new work is in a book called Adam, the Missing Link. And actually blows the lid off of the closely held package of historical and scientific facts that he has found that he says proves that the human race was created by genetic engineering and technology nearly a quarter of a million years ago. Interesting concept. You know, these ancient mysteries and these ideas are becoming more prominent in ufology. Stephen Jones will be there. He's from the UK, but he'll be at Aztec this coming March 26th. He's an experiencer, a modern-day ET contact experiencer after nearly, believe it or not, 50 years of ET contact. He is now able to assist others like him and how to move on through the barrier that restricts so many from understanding exactly what contact really is about. And I'd love to hear that. We're going to get Stephen Jones on, by the way. Stephen will be also at Taos, New Mexico, where Janet Saylor is having the 2011 symposium, paranormal symposium, instead of where she's headed for the last couple of years, Angel Fire. They're pretty close to each other. Anyway, we'll be there broadcasting, as usual. One of the guests this year at Aztec will be Robert Farrell. Dr. Farrell is a researcher, engineer, and a writer, and he's going to talk about the science behind alien encounters. And then, of course, we mentioned Lynn Buchanan a little earlier. He's a remote viewer. He'll give updated results from the remote viewing experts and the experiments they had for the 1948 crash site last year. There'll be more detail than ever, and some of it will be very, very surprising. They have a bike run going on there, too, the famous Alien Run Mountain Bike Trail in beautiful Aztec, New Mexico, will be going on. And a few other things, plus tours of the crash site, the thing that we heard Mark McClendish just talking about. They have three different tours going that day on the 26th, on Saturday. So if you can get to Aztec, New Mexico, I would recommend it. I haven't mentioned Chuck Wade yet. He's a researcher, and we're going to play an interview by Chuck here in just a second. Chuck says there's seven UFO crashes. That's right, seven UFO crashes in New Mexico. and they all happened between 1945 and 1948. And he'll be discussing in detail and showing his artifacts that he retrieved from the 1947 crash site on the plains of St. Augustine in New Mexico. And he'll reveal astounding results from recent laboratory tests of the metal that he retrieved. And I think you'll find that we're going to allude to this a little bit. But this interview was recorded, and I mentioned Janet Saylor's symposium up at Angel Fire. This was recorded in 2009. But it was an interesting interview, and I thought we should play it tonight, since Chuck's going to be there at Aztec. Listen closely. He'll talk about all of this, and he has an interesting theory on why all these UFO crashes happened in New Mexico. So let's play that interview now, recorded at Angel Fire, New Mexico, in 2009 with Chuck Wade. And it's always good to have interesting people with us, and Chuck Wade is a guy that we met at... The first time I think I met you was at the Crash Retrieval Conference.
Easily could be, yes.
Yeah. And at the time, you had some of the things you found at the St. Augustine wreckage, the UFO crash.
Yes, and I just happened to have a piece of paper with seven pieces on it right here.
And good, we'll take a picture of it. Tell our audience exactly what we're talking about here while you're looking for that.
Okay, in 2004, I attended the crash of the Aztec craft, and Mr. Art Campbell was one of the presenters, and he had on stage parts and pieces that he had retrieved from the crash, the UFO crash, from the plains of San Augustine. And as soon as he stepped off stage, I put out my hands, shook his hands. We became friends. Over time, we decided we'd have an archaeological dig at the UFO crash site on the plains of San Augustine, also known as the Barney Barnett site. And we did go down there. And what is here on the table now are small pieces that I physically cut from the bigger pieces of foils from that craft.
There's so many things to talk about here, but first of all, you've actually finally gotten somebody interested in analyzing this stuff.
That is correct. I had the good fortune to be interviewed by Joshua P. Warren out of Asheville, North Carolina, in February this year, and I told him during our conversation that I would send him some parts and pieces, and I did, and he had them analyzed a little bit, and they got interested in it. And then he was at the International UFO Congress in March of this year,
In Laughlin, right.
And I didn't know that he was going to mention the preliminary studies he had done on this foils, and he didn't know I was in the audience.
You were in the audience when it happened.
And, oh, my God, I got inundated with people that sponsoring laboratories. As we speak, there are parts and pieces of this craft in three continents and a number of laboratories. And each of these laboratories and their sponsors has said that they will put these results onto the new website that my wife and I are putting up. It's called ChuckWadeUFO.com.
ChuckWadeUFO.com. When will I be up?
I was expecting to be up the first of this month. And also our web designer, I thought, was going to be here at this conference.
But it'll be pretty soon.
But I would say by the end of the month for sure. And it's going to be really nice.
And we'll let everybody know when on our regular UFO Files news and sightings show when that's available. And you're going to have to keep us informed. You're going to put it right up on the website when you get the results back from these labs, right?
That is correct. We're already designing in places to put these lab results.
And do you have any idea of the preliminary results? What was that? What did that show? When you were setting the audience, what happened there? What
okay, we've had it preliminary tested back in 2004.
Uh-huh.
But what it was, we had it analyzed in cross-section, which means that you're looking at the end of the piece of foil. And these foils are different thicknesses, all the way from 14 microns. The aluminum foil in your kitchen is usually around 20, 24 microns. So we have stuff from all the way from 14 to 30, 45, and 65 is the thickest we've got on the foils. Then we have one piece that is 1/16 of an inch, and it's 1,500 microns. That's to give you how small this stuff is.
Now, how did you guys, was Art with you when you were out there digging around?
That is correct. He got permission from the homeowner and the landowner, and it's on private land, so we have to get their permission, and they absolutely do not want us to tell where it is.
But it's in St. Augustine someplace.
Yeah, it's on the plains of St. Augustine, and it's south of the VLA, the very large array that, if you saw the movie Contact, that's where Judy Foster is doing her work there with those great, huge telescopes.
Now when we talk about this crash at St. Augustine, is this connected with Roswell?
In a sense. In a sense.
Okay.
This happened on the night of the 1st to 2nd of July 1947. Roswell happened specifically on July the 4th, 1947. But your audience may not know, there were four crashes. And the people that are researching this, they call them the Roswell incident, but they got them all mixed up. They say that the one there by Corona, and it left a lot of debris, so it must have been a big crash. But it also left the debris there, but also it went up just a short ways and crashed as a big hunk of junk, but it didn't have all its parts and pieces.
Uh-huh.
And that's known as a Deeproctor site.
Right.
Well, whenever you have the debris and the Deeproctor, let's call it the craft site, that doesn't leave anything to go anywhere. So the Jim Ragsdale site is 53 miles due west of Roswell, and Jim Ragsdale and his girlfriend were having a nice weekend up there. They physically saw a very major flash out to the north, and that's basically where the Foster Ranch is north.
Uh-huh.
So they saw this flash, and it was as bright as a welder's torch. And then they saw it coming in. They clipped the trees, went over and wedged between the rocks. And later on, they went over there to the craft, and it was broken open, and Jim Ragsdale physically went inside of that craft. And this is all by affidavit. It isn't just by my
imagination. Right.
And he said there were four dead aliens in this craft. And they went back to the pickup, and in the morning early, they went back to the craft, and they were gathering up a couple gunny sacks full of parts and pieces, the foils and things. And then they heard this big roars of motors coming up that mountain. So they skedaddled out of there, and that would be the military come and get it. Radio audience, I would like to know, how did the military know to be up the side of that mountain that night and to pick up a whatever crash?
Now, would that be July 3rd or July
4th?
July 4th.
I'm reasonably sure it's July the 4th.
Okay.
But what happened is there were also two other craft crashed at the same time. And the Corona crash would be the same. Let's say the three UFOs going in formation. The first craft that was, and ladies and gentlemen, the United States military shot these crafts down. They did
You're
this
convinced
fall.
Of them.
I am absolutely convinced of it. Because it makes no sense. Well, they could not have found that craft on the side of that mountain because it's heavily forested. My younger brother and I have been up to that site, and we were in the daytime with a map, and we had trouble finding it. How did the military know how to get up there? And let's go back to the plains of San Augustine. I've physically been there twice, digging.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot see a road from there. It's out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And here came the military. And there were three different parties there at the plains of San Augustine that morning, because it landed at night, and the archaeologist on the east side of the place saw that big gleaning area over there to the west. Something had happened that night, because it wasn't there the day before, so they came across. And then Barney Barnett, who was a Soil Conservation Service guy, he was out there going from ranch to ranch, but he was using a back road, not the main road because it's a long ways up. Well, not long ways, but
yeah, he was taking a shortcut.
Yeah, just take a shortcut from ranch to ranch.
You could just drive across the. Yeah,
it's a lot of land out there. Just drive of the old roads, and he saw it. So he was there, and he's a federal employee, and then also a family from Albuquerque, the Anderson family, and others. I'm in email contact with Andy Anderson. And he's still alive, and to my knowledge and his knowledge, he's the only one that he knows is still alive for this, and I hope this doesn't give me any trouble. But he was there as a five-year-old kid. And in 1990, Andy made a tape with Stanton Friedman and others, and for 34 minutes on this tape, Andy tells about what he saw there. And people criticize, how could a five-year-old kid remember all that? Folks, from number five till the time these other folks died, they talked about it. They had some really insight. And there were three dead aliens on the outside and one live alien.
That's at St. Augustine?
Yeah, I misspoke. There was one dead alien outside, a live alien on the outside, and two dead aliens inside. So there's actually four aliens at that craft.
Okay, and at the Roswell crash,
there could have been one at the Corona debris field, because there were two live aliens out of this scenario, and we know for a fact that Jim Ragsdale, per affidavit, there's four dead ones. Basically, from the affidavit that Walter Haught wrote about 2002 to be opened or unsealed on his death in 2007. He said there was four aliens there, and I'm going to assume, I believe, that they were all dead, but I'm not sure. Oh, and we haven't spoken about the...
No, you still have another one.
We've only talked about four so far. So let's go up to about 40 miles north of Roswell, and that's where the Walter Haught Colonel Corso site is. And the reason I say Colonel Corso... In Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, came out in June of 97 on the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions the crash north of Roswell. And then whenever Walter Haught's affidavit came out, it was north of Roswell. So that makes five.
Okay, now so they all happened in a period July 2nd through July 4?
That is correct.
How come it didn't happen all at the same time if they were flying in formation?
There was three of them that did happen at one time.
Okay.
But that one over on the plains of St. Augustine happened 2 days prior, so it wasn't in formation.
So perhaps these were looking for the other crash?
I predict not. I don't think that they look for anything. I've never heard of any of them ever coming back. Because these things may not be manned by an EBE with a conscience. We don't know. But there's a good chance.
The reason
they
I asked that you know, our military, they go back to the dead.
Yeah, but that's our thinking. It may or may not be their thinking. I predict it isn't their thinking. At no time have I ever read that they came back for anybody, and I've read a lot.
What do you when we talk about? There's not many people that know any more about the Roswell and associated crashes than you, by the way.
That's who?
Than you.
I think you're correct on that.
Yeah.
That is the crash part of it. The people that was involved afterwards, the cleanup and all that, that is not my forte at all. I want to know how they crashed, why they crashed.
And you say they crashed because they were all shot down?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, we had this story floating around for a while. This guy from Texas said that he was in a fighter plane that chased him.
I understand that perfectly. And I, with all due respect, I think that that is wrong.
Yeah.
If it was one crash, that would work fine. There were three crashes, and
so,
therefore...
So how did we shoot them down, you figure?
We shot them down using high-powered radar. And why I can say that is, whenever Los Alamos was put together in the early 1940s, the U.S. government and Atomic Energy Commission put in three high-powered radars to guard the skies over Los Alamos.
So they knew that the high-power radar would, affect terrestrial aircraft?
Well, I'm sure that, I don't know if they could do that, but they gave it a shot, and it worked. Okay. It worked because it was designed to fry the electronics on any plane, and they would crash.
So this would probably be in conjunction with Aztec, too.
Yes, that happened in March 1948, the year after this one, and I feel confident they shot that one down, too, because that thing was so big, somebody said, gave the order to shoot it down because it wasn't very long at all that the military showed up. And it was also on radar prior. And whenever you go to that crash site there north of Aztec, there's a plaque saying that this craft was on radar. So they knew it was on radar. So just turn up the heat and shoot her down. Use these small ones to triangulate it. And here they come. So whenever the military showed up for a, I'm going to put in quotes, a plane crash, they would have showed up with an ambulance and stretcher. They did not do that. Whenever they showed up, they were armed and ready to take control. And that's exactly what happened on the plains of San Augustine. Whenever Andy Anderson says that the military showed up, and the military came in with a military vehicle, obviously, but they didn't, they were MPs with loaded guns, and they were belligerent, and they herded these people back out to the main road, and they weren't nice at all. I mean, they told them they'd shoot them and all kinds of stuff. But then whenever these folks got out to the main road, what did they see out there? They didn't see ambulances. They saw a flatbed truck, a crane, tanker trucks. There's two airplanes. Andy calls it an invasion force. How did the military know to have an invasion force out on the plains of San Augustine, 1947, when absolutely there's not nothing out there? And they certainly wouldn't be expecting a plane crash.
We could talk for hours about Roswell.
I got
because,
you.
We're doing a documentary on Roswell revelations for television, okay. And we'll be back in touch with you about that.
Okay.
But I want to talk about it. You're interested in another subject here, too, that you talked about here at the conference.
My real passion is alternative energy. I've studied alternative.
I mean, you were pretty passionate about Roswell here.
I want to know how a UFO flies.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been hoodwinked for all these many years because a UFO does not have a motor in it. It don't have nothing. It don't have fuel tanks. It don't have motors. It don't have nothing. But they fly tremendously good. How? That's what I want to know. And I think that the foils that we have are part of it. We found foils, and I physically have foils from the plains of San Augustine. Jim Ragsdale and his girlfriend picked up a couple of gunny sacks of foil. There at Corona, there's truckloads of foil. And then in Walter Hott's affidavit on the craft north of Roswell, it had foil. That's four crashes, four foils. There had to be a major reason for
that
foil to be there.
There's a connection
there,
right.
And I think that the foils will become the propulsion system of the craft. And why I can say that is I've also been studying a method of taking one part of electricity and turning it into 18 parts of heat.
Say that again.
You take one part of electricity and turn it into 18 parts of heat. Then you can take that heat, turn that into steam to run a turbine, to run a generator, to make electricity. Use one part of that electricity back there to run your infrared light bulb. And you've got a self-powering generator station. Here's the drawing, and that's all it takes. I have shown people that, with this thing on a napkin. And we can solve our energy problem anytime we want to, folks, by just going to this.
Do you think you're the only one who figured this out?
Oh, no, I didn't figure it out. Dr. Tom Bearden figured it out. And about 3 or 4 years ago, Dr. Tom Bearden and his friend Kenneth Moore, they put the provisional patent application on this process onto the Internet and gave it to the world because both of them just didn't have time to do all this. So I took that patent application and took quite some time, and my wife and I came up with this drawing here. It's only 11 by 17 page, and I've we drew it out and all, and then I...
Is this a drawing on a website, too?
It will be.
Okay.
It will be.
Okay.
And then I sent this to Dr. Bearden and had him check it over. So this isn't just a wild guess. This is an approved, let's say, an approved from Dr. Tom
Bearden. Yeah, now where's Dr. Bearden?
He's in Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay.
Wonderful, smart man. And I'm going to, whenever you look in the physics books about, in 1983, you'll find a physics method called negative resonant absorption of the medium, which means basically nothing and it's backwards and it's wrong. The whole premise is this is wrong. Because in the premise of this physics book is, it says a little nano-sized particle becomes larger in diameter and this excess energy comes into that particle through the excess diameter. That's absolutely false. What that little nano-sized particle starts vibrating, and what it does, it goes into the Heaviside energy flow component, which we are forbidden to use. The Heaviside...
Now who for? How come we're forbidden? Who did that?
Because...
did the U.S. government...
No, it's the guy that started Chevron, J.P. Morgan.
Okay.
J.P. Morgan. Your audience may not know, but J.P. Morgan was very instrumental on getting the formulas that are used in electrical engineering made. And that was in 1892. They came up with, back about 30 years prior to that, say around 1860 or 70, a Mr. Maxwell, Charles Maxwell, came up with the Maxwell's equations. And this is 20 equations and 20 unknowns, and there wasn't six people in the world could solve them. It's extremely difficult. Also, in 1892, Morgan had these Maxwell's equations brought down to two equations and two unknowns, solvable. And then what he did, he took, and the left-hand side we'll call two equations, and that's fuel. Then on the right side is energy. So he's transferring fuel to energy, but then he made the absolute brilliant thing to screw everybody's sense. He made them equal. You have to put in so much fuel to put out so much energy. That is absolutely not necessary. Because I've got information and know-how. We can make energy with no fuel and put out energy. And one of these is called a motionless electromagnetic generator. Dr. Tom Bearden and his crew got a patent on it March the 26th, 2002. The patent number is 6362718. And that little machine there, about the size of a bread box, can put out 10K or 10,000 watts of electricity. And if they've got working models of it, it's not on the market because they cannot control the quantity of energy that comes out of MEG. And the deal is with MEG is there is no incoming fuel as we know it, and there are no moving parts. How is that for something that will be well worth having?
So where are we going with this? How are we going to do something with this?
MEG, the motionless electromagnetic generator, is hung up in the United Nations. Dr. Bearden signed, or their people, signed an agreement with a company that got money from the United Nations, a sizable amount of money, funded to put MEG in pre-production engineering, because it really, really needs it. And that was 2 years ago. They got funded. In 2 years, they've not released one penny of money. So they've done absolutely nothing in 2 years. And whether they'll ever replace...
The conventional petroleum industry has probably got a hold of it.
Oh, yeah, big time. And
how are we going to get this unfrozen? How are we going to get this going? I guess by talking about it.
I appreciate, Mr. Pippin. I really, really appreciate talking, because we, the people of the world, need to have this.
Now, where can they find more about this? You have this website coming up.
Look at Dr. Tom Bearden's website, and I'll spell it because I can't pronounce it. It's Chenier.org. Chenier. And the reason the name of that is that Dr. Bearden and his group had to move to France, and it was close to the Chenier Lake, in order to get an international patent that you spoke of, they would not give him a patent through the United States Patent Office, but he got it through the international, and that was a fluke almost. So
there is, at least the patent does exist, and so something may come of it.
Oh, I hope so.
And we've heard that the possibility that France may be a leader in this, maybe this is a reason.
It could be.
Yeah.
And also, while we're talking, I'd like to introduce you to GEET. G-E-E-T, GEET, the Global Environmental Energy Technology. I was at a conference in Albuquerque.
Just started to say, I think I met that fellow one time when he's having his first one. He's in Albuquerque.
That is correct.
Uh-huh.
And we'll have our Extraordinary Technology conference.
Don't you have another one coming up soon?
No, it'll be next year.
Next year, okay.
But it'll also be in Albuquerque, and then we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But this GEET, and like I've mentioned to start with, I've studied alternative energy for many years. This GEET is absolutely the most fantastic thing I've ever heard of, nor seen, or even could imagine.
And what does it do?
It turns almost any fluid into a plasma that goes right into an engine for combustion. And that combustion has basically no CO2. It has lots and lots of energy. It actually increases the oxygen content. And it's fantastic. And it's working.
So, in other words, when we talk about these alternative energies, you're saying they've been here for a while.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Since,
yeah.
Well, Nikola Tesla said in the 1800s he could build energy without fuel. That's what we're doing now. With the motionless electromagnetic uses the energy from the vacuum. This adapted NREM uses energy from the vacuum. That's what these UFOs use, is energy from the vacuum, because they have to have energy. And the energy of the vacuum is the energy between you and I and you and your audience and the end of the universe is the vacuum. It's not pressure, it's space. And that space is chalked full of energy. Here's where we got screwed. Back in 1892, they put in the electrical engineering. The vacuum is inert, which means there is nothing there.
Yeah.
That is an absolute lie. And you electrical engineers out there need to get off your can, go over to the physics department. They say there's energy in the vacuum. Why in the world our universities can't get together and say the vacuum is alive, well, energized? And electrical engineering folks are going to ruin us if they don't get off of the Maxwell's equations that are equal. If they just take that unequal part out of Maxwell's equation, we can solve our energy problem any day we want, because we can make electrical energy without fuel.
Chuck Wade, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And thanks for the revelations.
Thank you.
About Roswell and also about energy.
Well, GEET is the way to go, and I encourage you to look at my website, chuckwadeufo.com.
That's Chuck Wade, and he'll be at Aztec this year on March 26th. And if you're in the Aztec, New Mexico area, or you're ready for a vacation, it's worthwhile. If you're interested in UFO crashes at all, we can't recommend the Aztec conference enough. For more details, simply go over to their website, AztecUFOs.com. AztecUFO.com. Got to get it right on the web or you'll never find it. We've been dealing this program and last week as well, basically with New Mexico and the West Coast and some of the UFO happenings there in the mountain states as well as the West Coast. And I thought we would close out this week's show with a program that goes all the way back to February of 2003. Stan Gordon is the guest, and we are at the Flamingo Hotel and Casino in Laughlin, Nevada. The Flamingo does not exist any longer. We were at the UFO Congress, and that doesn't exist in its old estate. It's now moved to Phoenix. But I guess we'll take down a trip down memory lane. And at the same time, I thought it'd be interesting to give a little equal time to the East Coast. And Stan Gordon knows everything there is to know about Pennsylvania.
not only about UFOs, but also about Bigfoot. And I think you'll find this interview very, very interesting. So let's take a journey back in time, jump in the time machine, and go to 2003, February 2003.
Now, you've been investigating other things besides Kecksburg, and we want to get into Kecksburg before you leave the show, but you've got some pretty interesting things going on now in Pennsylvania.
Well, I've had a UFO hotline open in Pennsylvania since 1969. I started researching phenomena when I was 10 years old back in 1959. I've been out in the field since the 60s. And I've worked on thousands of cases, and UFO sightings, Bigfoot, other strange animals, all kind of anomalies, and reports come in on a continuous basis. My hotline's been very active. I have quite a good input of free information from the news media, law enforcement people in Pennsylvania, and I get lots of emails coming in daily pertaining to these events.
Now, that hotline number, it's on your website, but maybe you give it to the radio listeners.
Sure. It's area code 724-838-7768. They can also write to me at P.O. Box 936, Greensburg, PA 15601.
We'll give that telephone number and address and the information. They can order the DVDs there as well.
They can call me directly. You can write to me. You can get the ordering information off the website, and you can just mail in, or you can order through the PayPal through my website on the website as well.
Interesting that you've talked about this DVD before, and I know when I watched the Sci-Fi Channel one, for instance, you had some pretty interesting things that were developing, and not all of it was on the channel at the time.
Well, the investigation continues. I mean, I have a lot of input coming in, even from more recent people, witnesses coming forward who were involved in the case, or people who have other knowledge pertaining to the case. The investigation continues from the Coalition of Freedom of Information backed by the Sci-Fi Channel, with the investigation trying to uncover more information on it. And, of course, on December 9, 2003, the 38th anniversary of the event, they did file a lawsuit with NASA pertaining to the event at Kecksburg.
Talking with Stan Gordon here, and we're talking about Kecksburg and other things that he covers in Pennsylvania. Interestingly enough, one thing that I really would like to follow up with you is this fact that this truck driver or whatever saw this alien body hanging or sitting on a little ramp or a bench or something there. Tell the listeners a little bit about that, and if there's anything more to it, have you been able to verify that or whatever?
Well, that's something I uncovered actually when I was working on this documentary. In fact, the interview with that gentleman's on this one I produced, and I didn't know about it until we went to interview him. We had previously talked to him. Investigation had been done with information we had obtained from him and a second truck driver who was also involved in the event. The late Leonard Stringfield helped investigate the case as well, the pioneer involved in UFO crash retrievals. And I got to tell a little bit of a story first, because people probably don't know the whole scenario, what happened. You want me to give them a brief
talk? No, I would love to hear the whole thing set up again, because you're right. We get new listeners, people are not familiar with it, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, just very briefly, late afternoon, December 9, 1965, multitudes of witnesses observed this brilliant fireball moving across the sky over a large geographical area. The object comes in over the greater Pittsburgh area. There are multitudes of phone calls to the police departments and news media. People seen this brilliant object in the sky. Some people thought an airplane exploded. What we now know is that the object proceeded roughly eastward into Westmoreland County over the city of Greensburg, made a turn towards the south, was reported by various people along the path in the rural communities out there. It moved towards the south, towards the village of Laurelville. Out in that area, it turned, began to proceed back now towards the northeast, and turned down into the woods outside of the village of Kecksburg. The people saw it come down said, this didn't come down at the high rate of speed. It appeared as though it was making a controlled landing. It came in very slow. It was coming parallel with the ground. It came in slowly, went down into the woods. And what we now know is that some locals got down there and saw the thing semi-buried in the ground and got down there and saw it before the military arrived. What witnesses say they saw was a large metallic acorn-shaped object with like a raised-up area on the end that had unusual markings that some feel would look similar to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. The object, again, semi-buried in the ground, estimated to be approximately 10 to 12 feet or more in length, about 8 to 10 feet or so in diameter, tall enough for a human to stand inside of it. And what was interesting, no rivets, no seams, no fuselage, no weld marks. It looked like one perfectly solid piece of metal. The military came into the area within a relatively short period of time. There are some witnesses that swear that at least a very small contingency began to come in even within an hour or so into the general area. They may not have known where to go to the crash site because you're talking about a lot of woods and a lot of mountains out there. But during the next several hours, during the evening, is when a lot of the military began to show up. And I've interviewed hundreds of witnesses who were involved directly or indirectly, and so many saw Army personnel, Air Force personnel. Others claim to have seen NASA personnel involved in the event. Others talk about men in dress suits who were involved in the event that seemed to be very powerful and may have been running the operation or certain aspects of the operation. And what we now know is the military, we definitely feel the military recovered the object, according to eyewitness accounts. It left the area around 1 o'clock in the morning on a large military flatbed tractor trailer truck with a tarpaulin over it, came out of the area at a very high rate of speed with a military escort. And what I've now obtained from other sources is that the object was taken first to Lockbourne Air Force Base outside of Columbus, Ohio, got there in early morning hours, December 10th, was under very, very heavy security, was backed into a hangar temporarily. The guards, the security team, was given a shoot-to-kill order to anybody approached it without the proper identification. It wasn't there very long when it was taken over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, here's where we get into the story of Myron. Myron contacted me after the Unsolved Mysteries did a show on this in 1990. Myron said the reason he's calling me now, since it's on television, he thought he'd be allowed to talk about it. Because when this happened, he said he was threatened, was told not to talk about it, or they put him in jail and throw away the keys. But in 20 years, this would all be public knowledge. And, of course, that's not the case even today, over 38 years later. Myron said that he worked for this large supply house in Ohio, that a Navy representative brought in an order, a large order for a special type of glaze engineering bricks to be sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So the orders came through. Another truck driver took the first load into Wright-Patterson, which we interviewed him, and he was very reluctant to talk to us, but finally he did, and he verified that, yes, he was there the day before Myron was there. And when he got there, here is a flatbed trailer outside of this warehouse building at the base, and on it is this large object that he described like a Liberty Bell shape with a tarp over it. The next day, both he and Myron went back with truckloads of these bricks. They were escorted in. They were told to stick with your vehicle, don't be looking around at anything. But Myron became very intrigued by the fact that there was personnel going in and out of this warehouse building with white coveralls, with sidearms, with some type of protective gear. They appeared to be Navy from the what he could see. They were related with the Navy, not the Army or Air Force. And they were periodically changing outer clothing. So he waited till everything looked clear, and he went in and looked from the entrance into the building, and he said, up on the scaffolding, here's this big bell-shaped object, kind of a bronze color, has a raised-up area at the bottom, strange markings on it. There's ladders going up to it. They have like a parachute on top with a light down, not lit real well. Parachute-type device is kind of hiding this thing, and these guys are working on this, apparently trying to get inside of it. Well, apparently there was a little bit of communication with one of the people there, and at first must have thought he had clearance, but soon realized he didn't, and that's when basically he was threatened and told, if you talk about this, we're going to put you in jail and throw away the keys. But in 20 years, this will all be public knowledge. So he kept quiet. But when we went to interview Myron, we had already interviewed him about that aspect of it, but we were all kind of shocked when he told us something else. When we got there, you could see Myron was not in good physical shape. He was on oxygen. He had lots of other physical problems, didn't look real good. And he said there was something else he had to tell us. And he goes on to describe that besides seeing the object, there was a table. And on the table was a body. And the body wasn't real large, approximately 4.5 to 5 feet tall, he estimated. There was a white covering over it, a sheet or something over it. And he said all he could see was an arm hanging down off the table with three index fingers. And to him, the skin looked reptilian. And that's all he saw. He wouldn't exaggerate. We tried to make him change the story. He wouldn't do it. He said, that's all I can see. And he said the only reason he's telling the story now is because of his condition that he may not be around later to do it. And that's kind of intriguing because there's kind of a more recent development now. November 2002, as our local media was covering the stories about the Sci-Fi Channel doing a very serious investigation of this, more and more people began to come out of the woodwork again. I mean, periodically, I get this, but as this was coming out, others who were involved, there are so many people involved in this case, it's just amazing. And they started to contact me about their experience, the experience they knew of others or friends or relatives who were involved. Some were now deceased. A particular name came up, and we'll call this person Joel. This guy's in his 60s, a retired fellow, worked in the area for years. But I recognized the name. And I recognized the name from input we had maybe 12 years before, when we were given a source that indicated they thought this fellow had been down in the woods that night, had watched some of the military recover the object. So we contacted him back then, and basically he would not say it didn't happen. His big concern was that his family didn't want him involved, and he was concerned the government might go after him if he said and described what he experienced that day, and that was his big concern. He wouldn't talk to us. So now, in November 2002, he comes up again. And we did talk to him, and we arranged to have an interview with him. When I got out there, he said, you know, I thought about this, and I was going to call you and just cancel it because my family doesn't want me involved in this. And his big question to me was, well, have I ever been contacted by the government and threatened? And, of course, I said, no, I have not been. And he said, well, he was concerned the government might come after him. Anyhow, we proceeded with the interview, one of many, spent a lot of hours with this fellow. And like he said, I'm getting up in age. Things started to get a little confused. There's some things I remember very clearly. He remembers a lot of details, but he said, you know, things are starting to get a little changed, but there's some things I do remember very well. And he gave me lots and lots of details. And a lot of it fits in with what we know from other sources. Some is not well-known information. And some of the things he said helps to clear up some of the little mysterious aspects. We couldn't figure out a piece of the puzzle that didn't fit. But anyhow, what he goes on to say is, as we're talking, all of a sudden his demeanor changes. And you can see there's something beginning to bother him. And he began to come out with this, that besides the fact that he sees the eye, he's down in the woods, he sees this like electrical arcing and attracts attention to it, that he's hiding down in the woods when the military's starting to come down. And he said, and he had been in the Army himself, so he knew Army, Air Force. And he said he watched an Army general jump onto the object and got on top of this thing. And he had some kind of a tool that he said it was similar to a policeman's billy club, but it was longer. And he said for whatever reason, this officer struck the object with this tool, and he hit it so hard it bounced out of his hand. And he said momentarily, like within seconds after he did this, on the front of this object was like an appendage that stuck out from the front, which is something that was not very well known.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, everybody always talks about it was slick and covered up. And
well, it may well be that other witnesses now didn't see that, but it could have been that by the time he got there, some of the dirt may have settled around that thing. But some other witnesses who saw it close up or saw it going over described this protrusion out to the front. But he said it was like a, what would we say, a valve, something along that line, that it opened. And he said it opened up, and this long arm came out and went up and over it. And he said all he could see, the way it was positioned, when that latch was open, was like two fingers. And he said it was like very elastic and very elongated. And he said it was a matter of seconds. And he said that closed. And he said when it closed, you could hear it hit metal on metal real loud. And he said there had to be another arm to pull it down, but he couldn't see it from where he was. So all he could see was this long arm and two fingers. But there's some similarities with what Myron described. So you have to wonder, what was there something inside of this thing? Was everybody's imagination? And then you got to look at, for example, what witnesses described in the scene, such as Bill Weaver, a very competent witness, who's up in the lane where various people were that night on the side of the wooded area where a lot of the military presence was. And Bill describes seeing this big box van pull up. And out of the box van are his four fellows in what he called the moon suits, the protective gear. And they had this box-shaped device that he figured was about 4 or 5 foot square. And they took it down on a stretcher-like device before them, carried this down into the ravine. Other witnesses described seeing it as well. Now, the box is too small for the object, so what was the purpose of the box? What were they going to put in it? Of course, we don't know.
It makes you think that maybe they're putting this beam.
Well, we don't know that. as I've specified many times, there has never been any reports of anybody seeing an actual body at the site. But
what about the scream? That's kind of new, too, isn't it?
Yeah, but what I want to emphasize is the fact that there have never been any bodies at the site, but there have been rumors for quite a while that allegedly two bodies associated with the object were recovered. That's all I can tell you about that. The scream is something relatively new. This, again, came from a fellow named Don Sebastian, very competent witness. He kept his mouth shut for quite a while. He didn't live in the area. He lived near Johnstown, about 40 miles away, but he and his buddies, they were teenagers at the time, heard the breaking news stories about the alleged UFO crash that night. So he, like so many others, began to come into that little rural community to try to see what was happening. Well, by the time they got there later in the evening, there was roadblocks, and roads were shut down, and they said he was there with his friend and his friend's girlfriend. And he said, man, we came a long way just to see nothing. So he didn't want to take no for an answer. He was stopped at a roadblock. State police stopped him, pulled up the road, pulled off. And at that point, as I recall, his friend's girlfriend was crying, was getting pretty upset, didn't want to get out. So her boyfriend stayed in the car, and Don got out, and he found his way past the hit and got past the roadblock and found his way down into the woods. Again, they didn't know the area. He describes generally the same farm lane that all these other witnesses describe where most of the activity was taking place. And he came across two large trucks, which he told me initially were like large military flatbed tractor trailers, which other people described seeing two flatbed tractor trailers out there. And actually what he did, he climbed on top of one of these things and looked over top of it so he could look down into the ravine. And he said these trucks had very bright searchlights on. The one in particular he was on was shining down, and he said there were soldiers right in front of them that were armed, but they apparently couldn't see him because the bright light was shining in their eyes. And he said, what's so amazing is I'm looking down there, and I can clearly see down at the bottom of that field in the ravine, approximately maybe around 100 soldiers, all walking in a single-line formation with rifles at hip level aimed towards the woods. And he said, these guys are walking along. He said, it looked like they may have done this before, the way they were such perfect precision. And he said, all of a sudden, there's this horrifying scream. And then moments later, there's a second one. And he said, at that point, after hearing this, he didn't wait around any longer. He said, it just made the hair on the back of his neck stand up, and he got out of there and ran back to the car, told his friends about it, and got out of there. Now, what the screams are, how they relate to it, of course, we don't know.
It's interesting it'd be so long before that story of the scream comes out, but I guess in your investigations, that's the way things work. People, I don't quite understand, but that's I know in things I've done. People talk to you and talk to you, and then all of a sudden they mention something that really, you would think would be the first thing they'd talk about.
Well, you've got to also understand, on the side he's on, it's far away from where most of the crowds are, okay? I mean, if you see the geography of that area, if you're not at the right place at the right time that night, you couldn't see what was going on. He's on the far side of the woods, where hundreds of people are jammed up on this little narrow road overlooking the area, but they're far on the other side, and that's where most of the activity is. Those people up there, including most of the media, apparently had no idea what was going on the other side of the woods where all this activity was happening. And like so many witnesses I've interviewed with the case, the small number of people that you've seen on TV being interviewed is just the sampling. The majority of people I've interviewed don't want any publicity. These aren't people. I mean, this is a small community. You know, these are a lot quiet people. A lot of these are, some of these are VIPs now, very credible people. A lot of these people are engineers, school teachers, police officers. But back then, they were young kids or teenagers who were involved in this event. And when they grew up, they became educated. A lot of them are in high-placed positions, and they don't want any publicity. So that's something I've dealt with. And that's what's so interesting about this case, because most people involved don't want any publicity. And their testimony, in so many cases, verifies other people's accounts that they don't even know.
We're talking with Stan Gordon, and we're talking about the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania incident right now. Stan is a UFO investigator of some note, and we will talk to him about some of the things he's been involved in lately, because it's not all just Kecksburg.
Oh, that's correct. UFO reports come in all the time. And, of course, a lot of reports, UFOs, creatures, Bigfoot, whatever, while a lot of these cases seem to be strange on the surface, of course, when we've investigated them, and when I had my research group for years, we had many cases we looked into, and most turn out to be a natural man-made in origin, but there's that percentage of cases you get every year you can't dismiss. And many of these, especially UFO cases, are just amazing cases. Not lights in the sky, but sometimes large structured craft observed at very close range, some in daylight, many times by multiple eyewitnesses, in some cases where there's physical evidence or physiological effects have been reported over the years in some cases. And some of these cases are just amazing. And you still hear these cases, not like you did in numbers back in the 60s and 70s, but they still occur.
We're talking with Stan Gordon now. The thing that comes to mind every time I talk to you, Stan, about this is the fact, where's the Kecksburg story going? Is it dead, or do you think if there's two creatures or two people or two whatever discovered there, they had to go someplace?
Okay, reword that question.
Okay, basically, I'm saying if there were two creatures that they found, like you're saying that that's been a rumor, where would they have taken them?
Well, again, the rumors persist that allegedly there were two bodies associated with the object that were recovered. We don't know if that's even true. This is kind of new with the two different people claiming that they saw basically just appendages, okay? And we don't know how that associates, but if their statements are correct and they're true, then we have to look at the possibility that there was someone or something inside the object. And, of course, we know the object ended up a Wright Patterson. And that one witness, Myron, says he saw that what he saw in the building was that Wright Patterson.
My question, or the point of it is, there's no evidence other than just this peripheral thing, the stories you're hearing. But do you have a place you're following? Do you think they're still at Wright-Patterson, or is there a place that you don't have any idea?
Oh, of course we have no idea. Myron tells me, he said, even today, if he could get access to the base, he drew me maps, including street names, everything. He said, I could take it right to the building. Now, of course, whether the object's still there today, of course, we don't know, and probably we'll never know.
Is there any way, how does the military treat you? You said that they had not really ever contacted you.
Well,
have they?
There have been many attempts through the Freedom of Information Act. I started that back in the 80s. And, of course, the Coalition for Freedom of Information, backed by the Sci-Fi Channel, has been very busy with their FOIA efforts to get data on this for the last year. And, of course, right now they're persisting with the investigation. We're tracking down various leads. And, of course, they filed the lawsuit against NASA pertaining to the event, which is, you know, right now that's very new information. And I don't have the dateline on it, but probably within the next several weeks there's going to have to be some kind of response from NASA as to what exactly, you know, their response is going to be concerning that FOIA request.
Basically, what I was getting at is a lot of people are deathly afraid of the military because they say, hey, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail or whatever, but no one's really ever threatened you as an investigator, right?
I have never been threatened, and some things have happened that are kind of odd pertaining to the investigation. I didn't reveal this till the MUFON conference in 2000 when I wrote the paper on it, but it wasn't until 1987 that we had located our first actual eyewitness who saw the object on the ground. Up to that point, it was eyewitness testimony, seeing this fiery object, something coming down in a large wooded area, but not knowing the exact location where it came down and the fact that nobody had actually seen an object up to that point. Well, it wasn't long after we had this information from this witness, and, of course, there had been some news media coverage of it, and I had done some radio talk shows and all about it, that some oddities began to happen on a more personal level, which other people were able to verify. Another relative, my first wife, others who can verify the story. First of all, I began to have a lot of things happening in my mail, especially mail pertaining to the case coming in from other countries, so it would be neatly slid open. And that was happening kind of frequently for a short period of time, as I recall. The other thing that was more interesting was that, and this is something I hadn't heard till other people in the family heard it, because I had phone lines upstairs and downstairs, and what they were finding was that apparently somebody was monitoring the conversations in our home, not just a bug, but they were actually listening to conversations, because you could pick up a phone downstairs and hear every sound upstairs in the house amplified 100 times.
You know, we've done shows about that. Evidently, the government has the little receiver in the phone They do not even have to call you or anything. It's just there.
Right. And that was going on. Then another event happened where a person in the house, there was a knock on the back door, which would be unusual to come to our back door, and the fella came around, and this is when we were having problems with the phones, electronic noise, electrical noises, interference, that type of thing going on, and we never reported it. And he came to the back door, and he said, I'm here from the phone company. We understand you're having some phone problems. And Party said, well, basically, you know, we didn't call anybody. You have some ID on you. And he said, yes, in my truck. It's up in the front. He never came back.
Interesting. So there's some pretty good evidence, or at least you have a clue that maybe you were under surveillance at least at that time.
Well, that's when some interesting things were beginning to break. You had the first eyewitness. Investigation was intensifying. More information was starting to come in. And so there could have been some interest at the fact that they realized we were on to something.
We're talking with Stan Gordon. We're here at the Flamingo Hotel in Laughlin, Nevada. And Stan Gordon is an investigator mainly in Pennsylvania, but today's electronic media, especially the web, people are apt to call you any place or email you.
Well, I get a lot of calls from around the country, throughout the world. I deal mainly in investigating Pennsylvania cases. I do keep in touch and monitor what's going on worldwide so I can compare with the local reports. But, I get quite input from quite a lot of areas.
Now, what's happening in Pennsylvania besides Kecksburg? There's other things going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, last year was a very active year. I had reports on 44 counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania of strange and unusual happenings. And that's just what we heard about, or other input I had from other sources. That's what we heard about. How much went on we didn't know about. That was UFO sightings, strange creatures, unusual, unexplained sounds, strange footprints, all kind of anomalies were being reported. And even this year, and I haven't had a chance to really fall on too many yet, but several reports have come in January and February, at least one alleged Bigfoot sighting, which sounds like there's something to it, some other UFO cases. Probably one of the more interesting cases, which I think I did email to you, was the last day of 2003. January 31st, very interesting sighting.
Yeah, that was interesting. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Happened up near Ligonier, PA, around 1:30 in the afternoon, as I recall. Woman's driving down one of the main roads, Route 30, heading, I believe, was westbound, and she observes this object flying through the sky, coming down in her direction on the opposite lane, but moving in her direction. At first, she thought it was a big bird, but then realized there's no wings on it, and it's coming closer to the car, that it gets very close. And what she's seeing is a large cigar-shaped, well, not large, it's a cigar-shaped object, only about 12 inches in length. And it's metallic, and it has these unusual, like, lines going down the side. And it comes real close to the car, it stops, it reverses direction, begins to pace the car, fall down the road, and comes up right in front of the car on top, hovers, and then shoots right over top of the car and disappears. No sound to it.
You talked a bit about Bigfoot sightings too, and that's an interesting thing you just told me. Like I said, that's that must be some kind of new model of an orb, I guess. An observer. I'm not sure what that is. 12 inch cigar is all about.
Well, those are very rare. I mean, over the years, I get reports these small spheres anywhere from a few inches to a foot in diameter, and those I've investigated quite a number of cases where they've been seen outside in daylight. I've had cases where people had open windows in their home, and they went inside their house and flew around and went back out the window. I had one case, it was amazing, Jack, 20-some years ago, where a lady had one enter her house and was flying around the kitchen. She got a broom, struck it, and she said it split into two identical objects and then flew out the window.
This is Stan Gordon, and we are going to talk about Bigfoot or something like that.
Yellow. Hi, Bars, Dick.
Oh, hi, Dick.
Okay, I talked to every advertiser in America and the U.S. territories.
Good.
Even Micronesia and the state of Yap.
Good, Yap.
Everyone's ready to start advertising again.
Great.
They now realize that consumers are ready to spend. I'm talking every single advertiser.
Yeah, except Debbie.
I thought you told me Debbie was in.
No, this is a different Debbie.
What's this Debbie's problem?
Well, she said the agency's new creative doesn't speak to her.
What's the product?
Dog food.
Does she have a dog?
No.
Does she eat dog food?
No.
Then she's not the consumer.
No, but she's really ticked off of their spokes dog.
Oh, a prima donna, huh?
Prima dog. This dog wants his own trailer, masseuse, use of the company jet.
Company jet?
Wait a minute. I know how we can get Debbie on board, Dick.
How about
get rid of the dog and get a new spokes creature.
I played a chicken once.
You played a chicken once. He played a chicken one.
It's called advertising, and it works. Your competitors know this. Why don't you? This message brought to you by this station, Adweek Magazine, the Radio Advertising Bureau, and the famous Radio Ranch.
Internationally acclaimed private eye Joe Culligan has a new book or video that may answer these questions. How much alimony does he pay? How much child support does he pay? Did he really graduate from college? What assets does he own? Does his divorce file say he beat his wife? Is he all he claims to be? Has he ever been arrested? Does he have a history of drunken driving? And much, much more. Before you agree to marry anybody, before you take on a new business partner, before you begin any serious relationship, don't put yourself in danger. Order P.I. Joe Culligan's When in Doubt, Check Him Out. The book or video is just $19.95 plus postage. Ship anywhere you wish. To anyone you care about. We'll ship confidentially. To order by credit card, call now. 1-800-921-9898. That's 1-800-921-9898. Specify the book, the video, or both. Don't risk your business or your life. Call 1-800-921-9898 now.
We're talking to Stan Gordon, and we are going to talk about Bigfoot.
Bigfoot Ridge is a mountain range that runs about 100 miles long from Preston County, West Virginia, through Westmoreland, Fayette, and Indiana County. It's a continuous hotbed for all kind of phenomena. UFO sightings, Bigfoot, underground sounds, things falling out of the sky, mystery animals. Year after year, reports come in from different people all along that path. And so many strange, unusual happenings out there, and I've investigated hundreds of alleged Bigfoot sightings, basically from the 70s up to the present. And back in 1973, just an amazing series of events happened, something I'll never forget. It was the most amazing thing I've ever been involved in. Had I not been directly involved, be very reluctant to report or even talk about it. And I did publish this a year later in the MUFON Symposium, and amazing story. I mean, the summer of 1973 was a very hot summer, as I recall. A series of events began to unfold, which went on for actually weeks and months. It wasn't an isolated event. And this all started out in late July 1973 when I received a phone call from a relative of a person who had been admitted to a hospital, which seemed to be related to the event that he had been involved in. As soon as he was out, I went to the house and interviewed him. And basically what happened was July 31st would have been the date, as I recall. The gentleman, it was a warm summer. Gentleman was shaving in the bathroom one night. It was hot. He had the window open, and he smelled this funny odor. He said, like a rotten cucumber, and he turned around to look, and there's these two glowing red eyes looking at him in the window, which is over 8 feet off the ground. His dogs are outside, but the dogs aren't making any noise, something we found very commonly in other cases as things unfolded. And slammed the window shut, ran out. The other people smelled the odor, came back out, and, of course, nothing there. So apparently the next day he had a heart-related problem that was he thought was associated with the event, was taken to the hospital, and went out to interview him as soon as he got home. When I got out there, I found out that there was more than just that story. I found that several young fellows, a number of weeks before, probably a month or two before, had been walking along that area near the old Green Gate Mall, a lot of woods and brush at the time. They heard a commotion, and they thought it was a deer in there. So they started throwing rocks in there, and instead of a deer, here's this large, hairy, man-like creature, about 8 foot tall with long arms, big gate crossing the road, went up behind the woods, up behind their house. So I had the chance to interview some of those fellows. They seemed very straight, gave me the story. I said, you know what, I'd really like to go up and take a look around. So I went with several of those people up in the woods, and lo and behold, we came across an area where there was what appeared to be a partial track, as I recall, but one very clearly defined, very strange three-toed footprint, 13 inches long and 8 inches wide, which I made a really nice cast of. You can see the bone structure, the muscle tone in it, and I called on the radio. At that point, I had one of my first research groups very active. We had a lot of scientists, engineers, research people. We had a two-way radio system set up that I designed, and called one of our photographers to come out, took pictures, make castings. While we're out in the field, we get a radio call from one of our members north of Pittsburgh that he had been investigating an incident that morning, and the police were involved, where a man had seen a tall, hairy creature looking through the window of a trailer about 9 feet off the ground, seeing glowing red eyes. Over the years, well, that was the beginning of the series of events that happened in 1973 that was going on for not just days, went on for weeks and months. And what's so intriguing is this was not happening in one small little community. This was going on over a seven-county area in western Pennsylvania. It was also taking place down in the eastern part of the area, down and around Lancaster County, where the Pennsylvania ducks were, where the farmers down there were reporting these big, hairy creatures were carrying off their ducks. And it was amazing because so many of these sightings were coming in from sometimes multiple eyewitnesses. Some of these were daylight sightings at very close range within 100 feet. Sometimes multiple creature sightings, large ones and small ones seen together. And in many of the cases, there was physical evidence at the scene. Now, again, this is when I had my group going. We had kind of a unique group that I set up. That was my determination years before to get quick response teams of research people involved in this. We did this all out of our own time and pocket. We didn't run our regular jobs, but we had some equipment. We built equipment. We had a lot of equipment we used out in the field to document this information, but we were on the scene sometimes within minutes to hours after these events happened. And because this was being taken very serious by the police and they were being deluged with calls, the police quite often were referring the reports to us to investigate. And in some cases, we would meet the police department or state police out at the scene of the events and be there simultaneously. And it was just amazing to go out and see the animal reaction. Something could not be fabricated. People can be fooled, but the animals can't. And in some cases, especially when these creatures were close to the dogs, dogs were terrified. Dogs wouldn't bark. They wouldn't move. They were almost like paralyzed when these things were close by. And in some cases, they wouldn't even eat properly for a few days later.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, stories about that Bigfoot creatures don't like dogs, and dogs evidently are terrified of them. Do you have an explanation of why there hasn't been a dead body? I guess they bury their own, huh?
Well, that gets into some of the really strange cases we began to uncover during that event, okay? As the reports are coming in, our feeling at first was we're dealing with some type of unknown zoological animal, but why so many reports? And again, we knew there were multiple reports and more than one creature because more than one creature had been seen together, and in some nights we would get simultaneous sightings from widely widespread areas. We'd be on the scene of one place, we'd get a call from the police to go to another location to investigate. And, I mean, at that time, I was lucky because I was managing a small little electronics firm at the time, and I had a lot of vacation built up, and I took a whole month off of work just to work on this full time. And I had people manning my communication center in my home 24 hours a day. Phone lines were just jammed 24 hours a day with calls. It was an amazing series of events to live through. But again, we at first thought we're dealing with some unknown type of animal. And then some real unusual reports began to come in. One of the first reports was from two women north of Pittsburgh who reported a white Bigfoot, and in its one hand was a small glowing sphere of light. Okay, that was one of the things. We began to get other reports, UFO sightings in one area, then shortly after a Bigfoot sighting and vice versa. Things like that were going on. And then we had a very spectacular report, and I'll just give you a brief summary. Occurred on the night of October 25th, 1973. About 10:30 that night, I got a call from a state trooper from the Uniontown State Police Barracks. He just came back from investigating a multiple witness UFO landing and creature sighting. He indicated to me that he thought there was something possibly still there, that we should send our team up as soon as possible. Well, it was a distance away. So we got our team together, and we got our equipment and started heading up that way. It was early morning until we got up there. But basically, the story is about 9 o'clock, there's about 15 people in this rural community out there. And they see this very large red sphere of light, about as big as a barn, dropping slowly from the sky towards his pasture. Well, the farmer's son, who was quite a big fellow, and two neighbor boys decided to go up and look at it. So he grabs his 30-06, grab some ammo. He has some live ammo, and he also has some tracers. So they begin to move up towards the pasture. When they get up there, here's this object about 250 feet away, apparently sitting on the ground or right above it. And it's now bright white, like a half a dome. There's this very loud, high-pitched sound coming off of it, like a whirring sound. And they're also hearing the second sound, like baby crying sounds back and forth. Well, they're watching this thing in amazement. They can't believe what they're seeing. And there's a fence line about 75 feet away. And along this fence line, there's these two tall figures walking along the fence line slowly in their direction. The fence post is 6 feet tall. These things were much taller. One was 7.5, 8 foot tall. The other one's a little bit taller. Thought at first they were bear. Then they realized these things are bipedal. They're walking upright. They have very long arms, almost hanging down to the ground, covered with long, matted hair. They have glowing green eyes. There's a funny stench in the air. And at one point, the one boy starts screaming, yelling to shoot at him. He's getting very scared, and he takes off, runs back to the farmhouse. The other fella does shoot a tracer right at them, and it's just a flash. Fires a second tracer, and he's at that point, the largest of the two creatures like reaches out like to grab the tracer. And the moment it does that, this is really interesting, the object in the field just disappears. It doesn't take off. It's just the light goes out, the sound's gone, and it's gone. The two creatures turn around, start slowly walking back towards the woods. At that point, the other two fellows run out of there, go back to the farmhouse, tell the family what happened, get them out of there, go to a neighbor's home, call the state police. Well, about 45 minutes later, the trooper arrives, and I'm here to investigate the incident, the flying saucer, and, of course, the witness said, forget about it. You can think we're all nuts. And the trooper said, no, I have to investigate. We had a report of two similar creatures in another location last night. So they go up in the patrol car up into the pasture field. They go over to the area where the object was resting on the ground, and the trooper said, at that location, the whole area was self-luminescent glowing, about 100 to 150 feet in diameter. He said it was bright enough. If he had a newspaper, he could have read the newspaper from the light coming off of it. He said he had a flashlight. He was aiming the beam into it. You could barely see the beam. The farm animals wouldn't go into it. They tried to push the animals, and they wouldn't go into it. And he was perplexed. So anyhow, they started walking around along the edge of the woods where they saw the creature, witness the reporter, and they hear something heavy walking with them. They'd stop and take a few more steps. They'd move. It'd move. They were starting to get a little nervous. The state trooper would never verify this part of the story, but the witness did right up to the point where he passed away a number of years ago, and I believe the guy's telling the truth. He said, at one particular point, they hear a noise, they shine the flashlight, about 10 feet in front of them is the largest of the two creatures. Between the creature and them is a fence. He has one round left, he fires right into this thing, and this thing charges at them, hits the fence, and they run into the patrol car and get out of there. At that point, they radio into the barracks, they both go to the barracks, they're both separately interviewed in two different rooms. And after that interview, I'm contacted, and we sent our team up. And it's a real interesting, I mean, there's more of the story. Dr. Berthold Schwartz, the well-known psychiatrist, came up and spent a week up here interviewing all the people, even wrote this up in a journal. And you can go to my website and read more about it, but it's a great case. But then there was another case that happened not too far from there in February of 74. As these series of events were still occurring but slowing down, that might give us a reason why we have not been able to catch one of these things. This happened again in February 74 up near Ohio Pile, up in the mountains, very rural mountainous area. Old mountain woman lives in a country out there, a nice little mountain home. Heard this commotion behind her house in the junk pile out there. They had been having trouble with wild dogs. Thought that the dogs were back, so she loads her shotgun, is going to fire over the head to scare them away. Opens the back porch of her home, and instead of being the dogs there, here's this very large, hairy creature. I'll never forget what she said. She said it was a great big, hairy ape. And she said there's this big creature, hairy creature, with its arms straight up over its head, like it's surrendering, and she fires right into it with her shotgun. And she said there was a bright flash of light, like somebody took a picture, and it disappeared. Now, that's not the end of the story. Her son-in-law, his family live in the trailer 100 feet away. They hear the gunshot. Call on the phone. She tries to explain what happens. He grabs his .45 automatic, starts running over to the house, and he said four or five of these creatures with eyes like coals of fire surrounded him. He starts shooting randomly at them. They run into the house, look out the window, and here's this UFO, like a big crystal tornado with different flashing lights hovering over the trees at the same time. Well, they call the state police. Now, some of you listening will remember it was in February of 74 that we had a nationwide trucker strike. There was gas rationing, you might recall. And I couldn't get up there that night because we couldn't get gas and it was snowing. So we got up early the next morning. But the state police and the National Guard, who were called out because of the trucker strike, both responded to the scene. And when they got up there, they were amazed. Now, the creatures were gone, but the animal reaction, here there's cattle and horses huddled together, and here's all these big dogs, like a German Shepherd, Eskimo Spitz, in their cages, and these dogs wouldn't move. They wouldn't bark, they wouldn't move. Remember the one state trooper tell me how he reached inside and grabbed and tried to pull the dog out? The dog should have ripped his arm off, and the dog didn't move. And he said, it was so amazing to see how these animals were responding, and something very strange happened out there.
Now, have there been any major sightings, like a lot, for lack of a better word, a flap of a Bigfoot creatures since then?
No, nothing like this as far as ever happened in history. There's never been such a long-time occurrence of so many dozens and dozens and dozens of reports went over, you know, a few-month period by so many eyewitnesses and over such a large area. And why it happened? Who knows? We have no idea. Nothing like this ever happened before or since. Yes, we get periodic reports of Bigfoot sightings every year, not like the numbers we had in 73, early 74, but you get reports every year. And I have to stress, most Bigfoot sightings are seen by themselves. Most UFO sightings are reported by themselves. This is a very small percentage of cases like this. And I am not saying there's any direct link. I can't say that. But there's no doubt whatsoever, and these are just a couple examples. I'm aware of many cases around the country where similar things have happened. Even here the last couple of days, other investigators come up to me and said, yeah, we have cases like this, but so many of the investigators are reluctant to publish it because they're afraid of being ridiculed by their peers. And my position as investigator is to document the information, to get it out, and those can accept whatever they want. I'm not trying to prove anything. I don't have the answers.
Incredible, incredible story. Now, I'm going to let you go here, Stan, but before you do, let's talk a little bit more about the DVD. It is available, and it's about Kecksburg.
Right. It's called Kecksburg, The Untold Story. It won the 1998 EB Award for the Best Historical UFO Documentary. Very detailed, a lot of information about the case that's not been seen on television. It's available on VHS or DVD, and you can order it either by writing to me at P.O. Box 936, Greensburg, PA 15601, or you can go to my website at www.stangordon.com, and you can order it through PayPal through my website.
And in addition to that, you do have the hotline, and let's give the hotline because you'll always pick up new people when you do a radio show.
Well, it's area code 724-838-7768, and my email is paufo@westall.com.
Stan Gordon, always a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for fascinating stories about all these things and a lot of new information, as far as I know, about Bigfoot.
Oh, yes. Every year reports are coming in. As I said, we just had a real recent report that we're following up on right now.
Thank you very much. That's Stan Gordon, ladies and gentlemen. October 7th, 1965. The light unidentified flying craft were near Edwards Air Force Base. That's up there in Palmdale, Lancaster, California, in the high desert of California, in Southern California. Now, here's part of a phone call to the base commander about the UFO sightings from an unnamed Air Force personnel.
We have everybody around has had radar visual ops on them. They're flashing lights running in the vicinity of old 4,000 to 12,000 feet of various observations.
That was an unidentified, probably an officer of the Air Force. He called the base commander at Edwards Air Force Base. The date on this again was in October of 1965, and he was talking about lights around Air Force, the Air Force Base, unidentified flying objects, in other words, and they were being painted on radar, as you heard as well. Now, in addition to that, I have a recording made the same night of the air controllers from three different sites in Southern California. That would be at Edwards Air Force Base, and I also believe Victorville. And we are going to play this for you right now. This is the actual tape from the control from the Air Force, I believe. Oh, this might be the commercial tape, but anyway, you can hear the Edwards Air Force Base controller on this tape as they later order a pilot to check out the UFOs over the desert.
You flew fast. Did you scramble on this or what?
Yes.
40,000 feet. Still low.
It looks like it's right above him in the tower now.
It looks almost directly above him and rising.
And, of course, as you heard that, the air controller said low. As the pilot spotted him, he was low to the desert floor at Boron, California. And he went up about 40,000 feet in, 10, 12, 15 seconds. Well, you heard it.